Would you eat your pet dog, your Fido? Well, in the 1911 expedition to the southern continent of Antarctica, a group of Australian scientists, explorers, had the honour of actually eating their huskies that were pulling their sleigh or their sled through the snow. And as they ran out of food, they had to actually eat their dogs. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Now, the moral of this story is more to understand the geopolitics, which meant that the great powers were going down and exploring and conducting science, and that's the ostensible reason people are in Antarctica. But you have the Russians, the Americans, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Australians, and a few other countries down in Antarctica with various bases, all conducting science. But there's also some geopolitical interest in being down there. And it's not that the geopolitical interests are polluting the science. It's just you may as well know about it and keep it in mind, so that when you assess sort of scientific information from Antarctica, you have basically an understanding. It's like pharmaceuticals promoting various drugs. Part of, I suppose, our due diligence is understanding it. So it's sort of background information. I did a podcast recently about ozone and an ozone hole, and Antarctic studies is a definite reason to be down there, but it's a little bit more complicated when you come to think of it. It's similar to people being very interested in the geology and the ecosystem of an area that they want to build a housing estate on. This is an interest, but there's other interests beyond the stated scientific interests coming along. So let's start off on this story. Now, personally, I've met the relatives of or the children of people who've been in Mawson's expeditions, and they have a lot of stories to tell which don't actually get into the history books. And if you read some of the stories about Frank Hurley, the photographer, you get a general idea of he's the official photographer, which comes down there, and there'll be a photograph with this post of Mawson walking against the gale force winds. So I suppose chronologically we'll start off with little bits of information that I do know. That pre-1911 it was decided that Australia should send some pretty expansive expeditions to Antarctica, and I think some of it was territorial when you come into it. So although there's no one owns Antarctica, Australia has claim. I don't know, quite understand how this works, to over 50% of Antarctica. And given that Antarctica is larger than Australia, that's a fair amount of land. And back in 1911, pre the Antarctic Treaty, it was important to get people down there. And going down to Antarctica, there was a base, and the idea was to do as an extensive land expeditions collecting rocks before returning to base. And there's a sort of scientific aspect. There's probably also a territorial aspect. I'm no expert on that. And so this is the age of steam. And there's various stories of Mawson, and I'll give you a bit of a character story about Mawson. Is really a super fit, super intelligent ultra scientist that the world has never seen. Definitely after him, I don't think we've seen anyone who's come really close to the sort of broad resourcefulness, endurance. I think the story of Neil Armstrong on the moon and his skill is, you know, sort of up there. But Lawson and Mawson, he's on the Australian $100 note with his Antarctic beanie on and moustache, looking out at us. And there's, I suppose, a small story of meeting his photographer, Frank Hurley, who on the train, he sort of argued his way on board the ship. So these are wooden ships leaving, I think, Hobart. And strangely, Mawson was with Adelaide University, South Australian University, and a lot of the research there. Their home was in South Australia. So they left on these ships. Our very first story I have from relatives is the story as of Mawson in the captain's, well, he wasn't the captain of the ship, but in the commander's cabin, and a university student. So this is hard to quite understand. Someone who was a researcher and not a a ship hand said, I'm complaining that I've been asked to peel potatoes. And look, I'm a researcher, I don't do that sort of thing. And Mawson was in the middle of looking at charts and stuff like that, listening, and he said, would you mind waiting here? I've got to step up out for a while. And this is on the ship there, and sort of time came to the pass, the student or university person was waiting there, and then people came in and they said, have you seen Mawson? And no one could find Mawson, and they began to search the ship, and he was down in the kitchen peeling potatoes. And of course the university student was mortified and just began to know his position, and without sort of a moralistic lecture. So that's a small sort of science leadership story. So they hit an area in Antarctica with the ships. Now, bear in mind, these are not icebreakers at this stage. These are wooden sailing ships, 1911. I think the metal ships are the at this stage are the dreadnoughts, the military ships, and they land in Antarctica. And I don't know what the actual base. I think it's still now called Mawson Base, Commonwealth Bay. I really can't remember some of the stories there. But he did pick the windiest part of Antarctica, which is 11 months of the year gale force winds as the cold air descends on Antarctica and slides off the highlands. So he had some huts there, and they sent out, off the top of my head, five parallel expeditions to go out, collect geology and information on one track and return on another in a sort of flower track, similar to the modern day military patrols, where you go out on a good coordinate, track around at 90 degrees, then come back in covering a flower. But Mawson headed up one of these expeditions, I think travelling west via the coast, and it was the most aggressive, longest expedition, and there were several people, I think four people, several sleds, and towards the end their food supply, which was on the slowest, heaviest sled with the most huskies and a person, went down a crevice. I really can't remember whether the person survived very long down the crevice, but they lost all their food and a lot of huskies down the crevice, and they had to return. I think maybe three, look, I really can't remember. I've just know the story told for me, and I think he had a Norwegian person, a friend who survived, and as they ran out of food, they had to take the weakest husky around the corner, and it would do a bit of yelping because it would work out that it was going to be shot. It'd be shocked, there'd be a crack and sort of a silence amongst the other huskies and surviving members. Eventually there was only Mawson and another person, which he who eventually died, and so there's speculation to this day whether this person was also eaten. It's not known. And there's a few food caches, critical food caches along the way, and one of the, I suppose, critical aspects of it is that unknown at the time, if you have a husky and you're eating it, although the liver is very nutritious, it has a lot of vitamin A, so much vitamin A that it actually poisons you with vitamin A poisoning. I suppose another aspect is that the cold was so intense, the skin came off the base of his feet, and so he had to re-put the skin on the base of his feet before he would keep on going. I'm not telling this very well, but it's giving you an idea of the long history of science and geopolitics and the funding of various bases down in Antarctica. So eventually Mawson comes and can see his huts, survival huts, on the shores, but he can also see, he's a bit late, he's a day or a few hours late, and he can see the ship leaving to go back to Australia, because it can't survive the winter then, and so he comes down, and fortunately some loyal people have decided to winter there, so he survives, the lone survivor of this entire journey, having eaten the huskies. And there's subsequent stories of with Frank Hurley, who's the photographer, I mentioned him because there's a photographic record. He goes with Shackleton in 1914 as their photographer. Mad leadership, it's hard to know, but his ship, the Endurance, gets caught in the ice, and they camp outside while it slowly gets cracked, and he has to actually dive into Antarctic waters to actually save his films, which is glass plate. Remember, back then they don't have the film, they actually have glass plates, and save the records, and Shackleton leaves his men on the ice and drags a boat up and actually sails to South Georgia. This is beneath the Falklands Islands, lands on the wrong side of the island, has to walk over a mountain down to the whaling village, and then rescues his men who are left on the ice. These are incredible stories. One of the things, I suppose, to put it in, some of the Shackleton's men, I think it's Shackleton's men, I don't think it's the Mawson party, to survive in the boat, had the practice of putting a lighted candle on the side of their head so they could read while the candle went down. Sounds strange, but probably true. This only came out because almost everyone involved in the Mawson and Shackleton went dutifully off to World War One, and I don't know whether this is official or I've heard this, or I've definitely heard this from a relative, so I don't know whether So that's just relative story. So this person in World War One still had the habit of putting a candle on the side of his head, and unfortunately everything caught fire in World War One when he was in the trenches, and he survived everything but eventually died in the trenches due to lighting himself. And Hurley became a photographer through World War One and World War Two, and a government photographer. And he contrasts very much with Murdoch. So you Americans will have our Mr. Murdoch. I think the grandson, the grandfather, would have to probably be the grandfather, was a correspondent, a war correspondent in World War One for the Australians, and the attempt to influence the politics and who's doing what via the newspaper was evident back there. And that sort of contrasts with Hurley, who's more on the scientific, working with the people. It's a sort of a contrasty way to get through, to get some sort of depth here, rather than a simplistic view of empires going down to Antarctica, and a simplistic view of newspapers and press. It's a much more complex tapestry of science, heroes, people, politics, and news reporting, and I suppose ethics and courage of everyone involved. So there's a few stories associated with that, and sort of gives a little bit of a basis that we have we're doing a lot of science in Antarctica. It's particularly relevant to Australia because it's the geology in Antarctica reinforces or clarifies the geography of Australia. It used to be the same there, and there's also obviously the ice cores, where you drill down the ice cores and release the ancient atmosphere, and doing various dating techniques work out the age there. There's also the trapped lakes, which encase ice, ancient DNA from 10,000 to a million years ago. There are that aspects. There's, I mean, a whole lot of interesting people. There's I know geologists who've trekked through the Antarctic mountains and found mummified seals and other things, which animals have become disoriented and trekked, you know, a huge distance inland. There's a lot of strange stories there. I know people who, when they're going into Antarctica, collect meteors because the meteors come down and really stand out against the ice. So meteor collecting it's almost impossible unless you really know what you're looking for to detect it in Australia. But in Antarctica, against the ice, a meteor sticks out quite well, and a very quick elemental analysis detects whether it's from the asteroid belt, Mars, or even the Moon. You can pick out different, just walking in Antarctica, you can get different pieces of information. So there's a lot of legitimate science there, and looking at the dynamics of glaciers, trying to predict the effect of global warming. So Greenland melting is one thing, Antarctica melting is another. And one of the major things with Antarctica, a lot of the glaciers are float glaciers, so when they melt, won't affect the actual sea level too much. But if the big central glaciers start shifting off the central highlands of Antarctica, then we have a lot of problems. So there's general points, general view there. There's the I suppose the one of the tidbit of random information. I'm just talking and letting random information pop into my head, coming out. The Americans have a look, I've only read this, so I don't know whether this is absolutely true, a chapel in McMurdo, which is their base down there, and with their base down there, they have a chapel with a stained glass window with a penguin in the stained glass window, which is sort of, yeah, that's a little bit cosmic. The purpose of these podcasts is to add a little bit of science to it. And again, there's some science which I report secondhand or just mention, point towards. If you're interested in it, you can look it up and verify things one way or the other. There's a lot of interesting geology and trees and dinosaurs and mountain building in Antarctica. One of the things I want to mention is the gale force winds, which are always flowing in Mawson. And although there's sort of a thing not to be culturally, environmentally sensitive, so all the waste gets removed, at least from the Australian bases, and bases and the buildings are supposed to be environmentally or culturally sensitive, even though there's nothing there. One of the things you could think of doing is building a wind farm there. Obviously, a gale force wind, a huge wind. You could design a wind farm which would definitely go, and that would definitely be an eyesore which people in Australia would object to. So hold that thought for a little while. I will just talk about the eventual fate of the Huskies. So you've got these famous Huskies which have really come forward when there's, even later years, things, mechanical things have broken down, and the Huskies have literally saved various Australians' lives. I don't think that we've ever eaten them again. But I could be wrong on that. So these are famous animals down there. But the CSIRO has their major, or the CSIRO and the Antarctic Division. Yeah, it must be the Antarctic Division of CSIRO. So they've done an environmental assessment of Huskies and identified them as a feral pest, and so they were going to kill them all, and there was objection, so all the Huskies have been returned to Australia, and there's the Antarctic Husky Owners Association, which insists that these dogs are surviving perfectly well in tropical Australia. So that's the final story of the Huskies. But for the wind, the incredible wind which comes down, at least through the Arctic base, it's if you Google wind speeds into dynamic wind speeds into the internet, you'll be able to get a dynamic globe which shows you the current wind speeds and historic wind speeds at all points, and definitely the windiest place in the planet is this place. Understanding this with the aid of the internet, trawling back through the invention database, the patent database, the general idea of having a horizontal Van de Graaff generator to generate high voltage DC seems an obvious idea now, but you come back, I think it's in the 60s, an idea. You have a fence which sprays and ionizes water or the snow coming past it, and this gets dragged via the wind away from this, and so the charge gets separated and recombines at another fence. And this is in fact a genuine way of generating a fairly hefty amount of high voltage DC power generation. And so this would be sort of a low impact thing, because there's definitely nothing living in the gale. You don't have penguins fly and getting caught in them. This would generate high voltage DC for the base, and high voltage DC let's think laterally now, for a internet reserve backup data center. You should be able to get the optical fibers to go in a one-way track down from Tasmania. There's very little activity there. The high voltage DC would power the data center, and data centers work best at cooler temperature. So all the data centers in the US, this is the Google data farms, are being sucked up into the Canadian cooler north. So the sort of environmental impact of this podcast, for instance, it's got a carbon footprint because it's on a Google server somewhere, or some sort of server somewhere, just chewing up watts. So there's some generalized interest there. So what I wanted to do is take you in a journey through history to Antarctica, a journey, a mental journey into the cold crevasses and the winds and in Antarctica, some of the science of Antarctica, and some of the geopolitical forces. These large, they were the imperial powers, and been replaced by America and Russia, and I think are now a big new base by China, all going there. That, you know, that America, Russia, the USA, Russia and China are all hark up to the Northern Hemisphere, but we're glad that they're all interested in there, all beavering away doing science. And as always, the science is not conspiracy. Look, in real life, conspiracy theories do exist, but they're usually some fairly not the brightest people running as scams and stuff like that. That's the majority of things. It's much more complex what's going on, and the role of newspapers and media, and I suppose today version would be Facebook and other things like that going on. So the story of Frank Hurley versus history of Frank Hurley versus Murdoch, in terms of Hurley is much closer to the actual individual story and the endurance required that, whereas Murdoch was much more into the sales of newspapers and the politics. The same direction or orientation into this is the reporting and our awareness of it, but there's a similarly nuances, all these beautiful nuances to go on. So this is Peter Hill Explains, and I hope this has been an interesting podcast to listen to.